My daughter, she wanted to read her paper, which she wrote in Italian, and I made her try it in English, and I think she did a good enough job. So. I'd also like to thank Jen for this, I don't have the right adjective, it's just this incredible experience of being able to be here with such a group of people to participate in what I really believe is such an important event. I really do think that this world as it is today would be absolutely impossible to live in and to bear if it wasn't for people like Jen and movements like Jen is promoting. So thank you, Jen. The title on the program for my paper is, which I will read, is Lady Welby, Semiotics and Mother Sense. Since I gave that title, I've changed the focus of my paper, Jen. It's all connected, but this title is centred on Lady Victoria Welby, a fascinating woman. But I thought more than spend the time presenting this woman, anybody interested can certainly read my paper in Athanor, The Gift. What I thought I would do is shift the focus from the woman to the problems and how the work of this woman can help us deal with the problems. Lady Welby wrote in the 19th century, at the same time of other very important theorizers in her field. She was concerned with language, with the problem of meaning, therefore with the problem of truth, with interpretation. And she corresponded and worked with all the people who counted at the time, but she was not known officially. Or it took her 30 years before anybody really took any notice of her theory, which she called significs. And she called it significs to differentiate her own position from theorizers who were concerned with the same problems, language, meaning, interpretation, etc. The difference, very interesting difference, is that she insisted that there's no way we can think about language, meaning, interpretation without, and therefore signs, without thinking about the relation to values. And that's why she introduces the term significs to underline the tight, inexorable connection between language, meaning, interpretation, and all these activities that we carry on when we are communicating, and values. That means that when we're talking about and theorizing about such things as language and communication, we have to think about values, which inevitably means thinking about such issues as responsibility and insisting on the need for developing a critical consciousness, which should push us to interrogate the world and the sense of things always. So this is an answer to what Jen says about this tendency to abstract categorization, which I think is a characteristic and one of the limits, a serious limit, in lots of the work that has been done and that we are still doing on language. The tendency to categorize, to apply abstract categories, and to make the existent absolutely invisible. And the existent includes gift-giving and the gift, which is structural to language, meaning interpretation, as comes out very clearly in an approach like Welby's. So to avoid raving, I'll read you my paper now. So the new title is Significs, which is the name that she invents for her particular theory of meaning, as against semiotics, semantics, semasiology, and other terms that were circulating at the time. Semiotics, which is the term I introduced with my colleague over there, Augusto Ponzio, semiotics puts together is a term that puts together semiotics, I teach semiotics, the science of signs, and axiology, the science of values. We need semiotics, we need semiotics and linguistics that is concerned with values and the connection between language, signs, and values. So semiotics could also be read as a modern interpretation, let's say, of significance, development. So significance, semiotics, and places of the gift in communication today. The first part is called gift-giving and significance. What is significance? Significance is that discipline, or better, theoretical orientation, that consists in obstinately asking the question, what does it signify? What does it mean? What's the sense? It's no incident that this discipline should have been invented by a woman, Victoria Welby. Nor is it an incident that this woman should never have entered the pantheon or genealogical tree of the fathers of the science of signs and language, despite the enormous influence she had exerted on such authors as Bertrand Russell, the American Charles Peirce, and again, the English Charles Ogden, George Stout, Baldwin, Ferdinand Schiller, Ferdinand Tönnies, Frederick van Eeden, and many, many more. What does it signify? What's the sense? These are questions that Welby induces us to ask in the face of many forms of any form of expression, verbal and nonverbal, any piece of human behavior or social practice, in the face of all languages in ordinary life, as much as in the professions, in intellectual life, in the face of scientific languages, the languages of artistic discourse, religion, politics, economy. As a significant, Welby put focus on the relation between signs and values of which languages and behaviour are made. From here, her invitation to interrogate the sense for each one of us of words, human practices, in the last analysis of the world and the worlds which we humans contribute to constructing for ourselves. What does a given discourse mean, a text, a given behaviour, and therefore what's the sense of a given social programme? What does education imply? Why poverty? Why exploitation? What are the implications involved in the progress of science? What's the use of definition, dogmatism? Why keep the different away? What's the sense in isolating that which is different, the disobedient with respect to dominant ideology? What is the sense of war? How must we respond to all this? These are examples of the questions that significance teaches us to ask, and Welby, in fact, was really concerned with education and developed educational programs to teach and induce people to ask, you know, these questions. With a focus on the dignity of the human person, Welby promoted and theorized the development of critical consciousness and interpretive capacity from infancy. Such themes are accompanied throughout her writings by reflection on the inevitable connection of signs and values with responsibility and freedom, and therefore with the capacity for hospitality and listening to the other alien to myself. According to the logic of significance, which is in line with the logic of new humanism, the humanism of otherness, to take responsibility for the other is inextricably connected with creative love for the other, care for the other, and therefore with a capacity for proposing new and better worlds with and for the other. Proceeding with Welby, beyond Welby, in the world of globalization, we propose to work for the construction of worlds which are no longer founded on difference understood in terms of the logic of identity. This is a bad word, identity. It's one of a perfect example of the negative effects of abstract categorization. We really need to think what identity means, and I assure you it's the object of equivocation in language, and therefore of practices and political programs. Indeed, thus understood difference means to construct worlds on the basis of identity separations, whether these pertain to gender, ethnic group, religion, ideology. Such logic inevitably involves the need to defend rights and interests connected with identity and belonging. even to the point of accepting the logic of war, which, impossible to deny, characterizes the global world today. Instead, in the perspective of significance, or what we propose to call semioethics, it is possible to work for the construction of a world that is founded on difference, understood in terms of otherness and excess. Such logic involves the capacity to stay together on the basis of intercorporeal dialogue and co-participation rather than prevarication. Global freedom, as much as global peace, cannot be separated from the relation of global involvement with the other, without identities, without barriers, without alibis, it cannot be separated from the relation of responsibility for the other, of dialogic responsiveness towards the other. And according to this logic, to be committed to human rights means to be committed, always and without reserve, to the rights of otherness. The gift is a constant theme throughout Welby's writings, both as the object of discourse, when she predicates such values as love and care for the other, compassion, justice, and patience as the guiding values for social practice. But even more radically, she identifies gift logic as a constitutive component in the relation among signs and in the generation of signifying processes and practices. Otherness and excess overflow with respect to identity logic are recognized as determining factors in the dynamics of interpretive processes and therefore in the development of expressive systems, including verbal language, which is all one with the dynamics of the constitution of subjectivity, the development of interpersonal relations and experience of the world. The problem, this is the title of the second part. The logic of identity in the world of global communication and market ideologic. The expression global communication refers to the capitalist or post-capitalist system in its current phase of development and may be understood in at least two different senses. In fact, the term global in the expression global communication indicates, one, the extension of communication over the entire planet, and two, the realistic tendency of communication to accommodate the world as it is. This is the era of the communication era. We can call it communication production, simply because communication is no longer what happens in the middle part of the cycle, production, exchange, consumption. Communication has invaded the whole productive cycle. Production is communication, exchange is communication, and consumption is communication. We produce and consume messages and communication. Globalization implies that communication pervades the entire productive cycle. That is to say, not only does communication enter exchange relations, as in the earlier phases of socioeconomic development, but also relations of production and consumption. Globalization also involves heavy influence of communication understood as communication production, not only on human life, but on life generally over the entire planet. Therefore, the expression global communication production indicates the fact that the communication network has extended worldwide together with the equal exchange market logic. But it also refers to the fact that life in its globality, including the human, has been englobed by the communication production system. The capitalist system today, in its global communication production phase, is characterized by the Industrial Revolution in automation and by globalization of communication and universalization of the market, equal exchange market. That the market has been universalized does not imply a quantitative fact of expansion, but also, and most significantly, a fact of quality. This is represented both by the translatability of anything into goods and by the production of new goods, things. Communication no longer concerns just the intermediate phase in the production cycle, but far more radically has become a constitutive modality in production and consumption processes as well. In other words, not only is exchange communication, but production and consumption are also communication. Therefore, the whole productive cycle is communication. Consequently, for this very reason, the current phase in capitalist production may be characterized as the communication production phase. It is important to repeat and to underline that communication production is the communication of the world as it is today. Communication production is global communication, not only in the sense that it has expanded over the entire planet, but also in the sense that it relates to the world, accommodates the world as it is, stays glued to the world. Better, communication production is communication of the world, that is to say, of this world. Communication and reality, communication and being coincide. Realistic politics, and if it is not realistic, it is not politics, is politics appropriate to global communication, to the being of communication production. The relationship between politics and ontology, politics proper, which as such is predisposed for war, the crudest and most brutally realistic face of being. The relationship, I was saying, between politics and ontology is nowadays specified as the relations with the ontology of being communication, which is world communication, communication production. On the other hand, persistence in communication reproduction is persistence in the same social system, the capitalist. Capitalist society, with its continual adjustments and transformations functional to its very own maintenance, its perseverance, has not yet ceased to set, has not yet finished ending, in spite of its only having emerged at sunset, the references to Hegel. In spite of the signs of its ending, ideology functional to maintaining capitalism identifies being, in this case the being of communication production, with the being communication of social reproduction in general. The being of communication production is so closely identified with the being of social reproduction in general that it seems natural. Indeed, the only possibility for human beings, an inherent part, as it were, of human nature. In other words, once high levels have been reached, according to the logic of linear development in the economic, cultural, and scientific technological spheres, being communication, or better, being communication production, is passed off as structural to human beings, a necessary and unchangeable modality of existence for the human species, which means there's no possibility of change, which is ridiculous. World planning for the ongoing development of communication and for control over communication itself goes together with the reinforcement and continued reaffirmation of being communication production, the market, equal exchange market. But I think I've transmitted the idea of what global communication is, what we should understand by global communication today. The European Commission has devoted special attention to the problem of inventiveness and innovation functional to profit. According to such, to material investment and competitivity as dictated by equal exchange market logic, according to such logic, which is the ideologic of capitalism, it is not surprising that the European Commission should have identified innovation with destruction. So innovation today means destruction in the sense that we need to destroy products in order to put new products onto the market, in order to keep the productive cycle moving. To globalize the market, then I talk about various forms of destruction. To globalize the market is destructive. This means to say that to globalize the status of merchandise applied indiscriminately to anything, including relationships, is destructive. Indeed, in today's world, the more merchandise is illegal, the more it is expensive. Think of trafficking drugs, human organs, children, uteruses. To exploit the work of other people is destructive. The more work produces profit, the less it costs. With the aid of a powerful support system like that offered by global communication production, developed countries are ever more turning to low-cost work in underdeveloped countries. The disgrace of communication production world is manifest in the spreading exploitation of child labour, which is mostly heavy labour and dangerous. Much needs to be said and done about the children. The destructive character of worldwide communication production is made obvious by war, which is always a scandal. Global communication production is also the communication production of war. War calls for new markets for the communication production of weapons, conventional and unconventional. War also needs to be acknowledged as just and necessary, as an inevitable means of defence against the growing danger of the menacing other. From this point of view, war is used as a means of achieving respect for the rights of identity and difference. However, the truth is that identities and differences are neither threatened nor destroyed by the other. Another jump. A way indicated by semiotics understood as global semiotics and semioethics, and that way I'll give you an overview of the whole paper. On our part, we propose a semiotic approach to the signs of the life of life and to the life of signs that is global and at once detotalizing. Such an approach is connected with the logic of otherness. It demands a high degree of availability for the other, readiness to listen to the other, the capacity for hospitality, for opening to the other, both in qualitative and quantitative terms. Semiotic interpretation must not prescind from a dialogic relation with the other. Dialogism, the condition of intercorporeity, is a fundamental condition for an approach to semiotics that is oriented globally, while at the same time being capable of opening to the local, which must not be simply absorbed and englobed. The approach we are theorizing privileges the tendency toward detotalization and therefore the other and therefore listening and therefore hospitality, rather than totalization and englobement, therefore power, identity, the monadic block, which needs to defend itself from other monadic blocks. Semiotics must stand up to the inevitable commitment to the health of semiosis. Semiosis coincides with life, therefore the health of life. The capacity for responsive understanding toward the entire semiotic universe must be cultivated. As stated in my article recently published in Jane's issue of Atanor, The Gift, semioethics may contribute toward, together with gift theory as conceived by Jane Vaughan, to a better understanding of today's world and of the subjects who inhabit it, and ultimately to radical social revolution according to the logic of social agapism, that's from agape, which means love. This is a happy expression proposed by Jen in a letter to me commenting my paper of 1997, Subject, Body, and Agape. As Jen says, gift-giving exists in many places, but is made invisible by patriarchal capitalism. In reality, gift-giving is effectively the basis of communication, including communication production in this particular phase in capitalist production. Inside capitalism, traces of gift-giving can in fact be seen on a large scale. For example, in economies of indigenous cultures, in such phenomena as women's free housework, or the remittances sent by immigrants to their families in their home countries. And even more radically, as Jen also demonstrates in her book of 1997, even linguistic work, or better, immaterial work, as we would say today, is also inseparable from gift-giving and, in effect, is itself gift-giving, linguistic gift-giving. And what we must also underline is that in the current phase of development in the global communication production system, linguistic work or immaterial work is acknowledged as a fundamental resource, a basic investment, which the system today cannot do without. I indicate various places of gift-giving in the perspective of significance and semioethics. These include, for example, inference, reasoning, the processes we are activating all the time to live, to think, to communicate, and to relate to other people. There are various forms of reasoning. One form is called abductive reasoning, which is creative reasoning, which, in a sense, is guided by the logic of otherness and is a place of gift-giving. In abduction, by contrast with induction and deduction, But the relationship between the interpreted sign, the premise, and the interpretant sign, the conclusion, is regulated by similarity, attraction, and reciprocal autonomy. And being grounded in the logic of otherness, abduction is dialogical in a substantial sense. Another place of gift-giving, strictly connected with creative logical inference, is what will be called primary sense, or primal sense, or mother sense. Victoria Welby proposes the term primary sense to indicate this particular capacity, which is common to men and women as much as it is sexually differentiated in our patriarchal capitalist society. This particular capacity for sense, primary sense, is commonly referred to with a series of stereotyped terms, including intuition, judgment, wisdom. In any case, primary sense is common to men and women, even though it may be particularly alive in the woman, owing to the daily practices she is called to carry out as a woman in her role, for example, as mother or wife, being a question of practices oriented by the logic of self-donation, giving and responsibility for the other, care of the other. Finally, I believe that individual identity itself may be indicated as a place of the gift. The individual is understood by Welby as a dialectical, indeed dialogical relation between what she calls the ident and the self. The ident is a generative center of multiple selves and at the same time a multiplicity inhabiting each one of ourselves. The ident is a dialectical and open unit with respect to the sum total of its parts, its multiple selves, with respect to which it represents an overflow, an excess value, a gift, in the order of, in the words of Welby, in order to be, and really to be is to be given, what is impotent for fertile being is not. There must be overflow. There must be, in some sense, gift. True that, in the arithmetical sense, the bare unit may be added to and may multiply. But that is just because it has no content and no identity, as it has no fertility. Full identity is generative, is a giver of its very self. The ident is an orientation toward the other, toward the self insofar as it is other, a continuous transcending and transferral of the limits of the real as it is, while the self represents that which to a certain extent can be identified, measured, calculated, the ident can only be approached by approximation, tentatively and hypothetically, but never captured, and only by working through the means at our disposal, that is, ourselves. Her analysis of the development of self is interesting because she underlines how important gift-giving is in forming the subject, which, in her analysis, comes through as really being structural, which is really avant-garde with respect to what is said about subjectivity and continues to be said about subjectivity. She says that individual is not a good word to indicate the human person from one point of view because etymologically it means non-divided. And we must be careful here because the individual, or the human person, is fragmented in the sense that we are made of, our identity is made of a great plurality of selves, is otherness. She, however, also says that individual is also a good term, a positive term, if we use it to indicate the self as a means and not an end, as a means which takes us, which leads us to life lived and experienced as a gift. Okay, I'll finish off there.